From Montana to Florida, Georgia to Wisconsin, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration has departed from some Trump-era healthcare policies, but not as many as you would think. Brian Blaze from Blaze Policy Strategies joins us with details. Hearings into the events of January 6th at the U.S. Capitol have turned into a politically motivated sham. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Could the United States restore the internet service that the Cuban government shut down to suppress the island nation's freedom movement? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here with the answer. And the legacy media's left-wing bias is showing in how it reports on the 2020 election audits and its coverage of the January 6th Capitol incident. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration has announced a number of policies related to health care. And while there are some key departures from the Trump administration, many of the goals remain the same. To sort through this, we turn to Brian Blaze, who is Chief Executive Officer of Blaze Policy Strategies. Brian, welcome to American Radio Journal. Brian, conventional wisdom has it that President Biden is pretty much reversing every policy that President Trump had put into place. And in many areas, that's true. But when it comes to health care policy, you are finding that President Biden is building on some of the components of President Trump's policies?
Yeah, Loman, he's building on quite a few sort of foundational policies. So the Trump administration focused on competition in healthcare markets, and President Biden issued an executive order on July 9th that seeks to build on several of those initiatives.
One of the president's goals with his initiative that he announced here a couple of weeks ago, Brian, is his desire to maximize competition. Now, some of the proposals that he has set forth will do the opposite. But when it comes to healthcare, would what the president's proposing maximize competition, and how would it do that?
His executive order has four main areas. One is sort of a common sense approach to hearing aids. So right now, you can't get a hearing aid over the counter. You've got to set up a doctor's appointment. They've got to write you a prescription. And the whole thing could be costly and inconvenient for people who are suffering with a hearing loss. He's proposed that his administration issue rules that Americans can purchase hearing aids over the counter, which is really sort of a common sense thing. I mean, people's family and friends know when an individual suffers from hearing loss, and that's not something that, you know, you need to go to a specialist and get a visit and get a prescription for. Probably the most significant problem in health policy, or one of the most significant, is growing consolidation in the market, particularly sort of big hospital systems. So hospitals that merge together and hospitals that acquire physician offices. And there, President Biden is looking to do two things that build on actions of the Trump administration. One is to look at sort of the appropriate antitrust tools that are available to scrutinize mergers to see if they are going to have sort of anti-competitive effects and raise prices. And he's looking to build on the Trump administration's price transparency rules. So, you know, the Trump administration thought that Americans should have access to prices before they receive healthcare services. And they issued rules that require both hospitals and insurance companies to provide that price information. And President Biden directed his federal departments to build on those policy rules.
Another area that has been, well, this has been an issue for over a decade now, is when it comes to health insurance. And Obamacare still managing to survive despite multiple legal challenges, at least in largely intact in its original form. What is the Biden administration's approach, Brian, to health insurance and Obamacare? Are they looking to tweak this in any way, or are they largely satisfied with the status quo?
Well, here are my biggest problems, actually, with the Biden administration's health policy. So just as a way of background to understand Obamacare, Obamacare, sort of the main part that we're talking about, are changes it made to rules in the individual health insurance market. And this is the place where people who are eligible for a government program or who don't get coverage through their employer seek to buy health insurance for themselves and their families. And Obamacare put a lot of regulations on that coverage, really significantly increased premiums. And it turns out that the only people really buying that coverage are individuals who receive large subsidies to purchase the coverage. So people sort of middle class, upper middle class, that don't get large subsidies, it's just unaffordable and it's unattractive to them. Rather than sort of dealing with the provisions that cause these premiums to escalate so rapidly, the Biden administration's approach is just to significantly expand government subsidies. These are subsidies that go directly to health insurance companies. They are problematic for a variety of reasons. They're inflationary, they're going to put upward pressure on healthcare prices and overall healthcare spending. This subsidy expansion is inequitable. It targets much greater aid to individuals that are upper class than individuals who have less income. If made permanent, these subsidies are going to provide a significant incentive for employers to drop coverage, which is a real problem given how extensive these subsidies are, which leads to sort of a federal budget problem. So the Biden administration is really pursuing a really inefficient health policy approach where they're spending a lot of money to insure relatively few additional people. And I think there's just much better policy ways to deal with the sort of reforming that individual insurance market.
One of President Trump's initiatives, among many in the healthcare sector, was to try and make prescription drug costs more affordable to middle and lower income folks. What is the current president, Joe Biden, proposing to do relative to prescription drugs? Is this an area maybe he's rolled back some of the Trump initiatives?
Initial big thing that the Food and Drug Administration did in the Trump administration was dramatically expand approvals of generic drugs. And what we have seen overall is actually some pretty good news in that prescription drug prices have been flat for about the last 5 years. And this is overall, when you sort of look at the bucket of drugs that people buy, it's in part because there's been a shift to these generics that are obviously much less expensive than the brand drugs. So the Biden executive order sort of looks to continue a lot of these policies, continue an emphasis on generic drugs and sort of try to inject some more competition into the prescription drug market, looking at allowing drugs to be imported from Canada into the U.S. They're much cheaper in Canada. That directly builds on a Trump administration policy where just last year the Trump administration began to allow Florida and a few other states to import prescription drugs from Canada.
We have been talking with Brian Blaze, who is the chief executive officer at Blaze Policy Strategies. Brian, tell us a little bit about Blaze Policy Strategies and where can folks go? You've written extensively on this topic on healthcare and others. Where can folks go to read that and to learn more?
When I left the White House, I stood up Blaze Policy Strategies, and it's blazepolicy.org, and it's a research and consulting firm.
Brian Blaze of Blaze Policy Strategies. Brian, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and as usual, not only is he keeping an eye on legislation in Washington, D.C., but also political developments around the country, all of this sort of coming together this week. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
The big talk at the Capitol this week has been this so-called select committee to look into the events of January 6th. That's when the Capitol was overrun by rioters, Scott. The Democrats and the left seem to want to keep this as alive as possible. Some major developments. They had their first hearing this week. So tell us what took place.
Going back to last week, I think your listeners know that Nancy Pelosi refused to seat Jim Banks, the chairman of the Republican Study Committee, and Jim Jordan, the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, to be a part of the Select Committee. The legislation said that the House minority could recommend 5 members to the Select Committee, and they had to be approved by the Speaker, and she took that unprecedented step of disapproving of McCarthy's picks, at least two of them. And so what happened was over the weekend, the second Republican accepted an invitation from Speaker Pelosi, and that was Congressman Adam Kinzinger, one of the 10 Republicans that voted to impeach Donald Trump. And I think everybody knows that the first Republican to accept Pelosi's invitation to sit on that committee was Congresswoman Liz Cheney from Wyoming, also somebody that sort of led the charge for those 10 Republicans in voting with all the Democrats to impeach the president. And so the Select Committee got together this week, and they had their first hearing. They had several Capitol Police officers that served as witnesses. They kind of rolled out the process for what the Select Committee was going to be investigating, and they started their so-called work. But I think really what it is a partisan and unfair, really an attack on mostly what we saw was protesters. And so Democrats are continuing to use this issue to hammer the House Republicans and make this a question about the House majority and where folks will stand when it comes to backing up former President Donald Trump. In Wyoming, we know that Liz Cheney is going to be facing some strong primary challengers. And this week, Donald Trump was in Bedminster, New Jersey, and he met with at least four candidates for the Liz Cheney seat, two of which are declared candidates and two that are considering running. This has all been reported. And so it was pretty interesting to watch as Trump has indicated he intends to endorse one of them, and then he will lean on the others to not run or to drop out of the race.
Looking at the composition of this committee, Scott, not only is it really a witch hunt from the very beginning, but by taking off of the committee the Republicans whom the Republican leadership had placed on it and putting on it two Congress members who are clearly anti-Trump, doesn't even now not have a fig leaf of propriety left to it?
Kevin McCarthy was actually at the White House for another event, a bipartisan event, and from the White House lawn, Kevin McCarthy came up with a new term for people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, and he is now calling them Pelosi Republicans. That means that they are basically persona non grata within the Republican conference. And I think that the Republican members of the House of Representatives are going to have to decide whether they're going to continue to allow Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger to serve on their committees with Republicans. Right now, they're a part of the minority when it comes to, you know, Liz Cheney's on Armed Services, so is Adam Kinzinger. And those are big, big committees. They're committee assignments that are really campaigned on for a lot of these members that have a military background and don't get in there. So Republicans are going to certainly look at Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, and decide, do they really belong in the Republican conference? And I think that they're going to have a vote within the next 2 months to decide whether to strip them of their committee responsibilities. So we saw this sort of the show that Adam Kinzinger put on from the committee hearing. He ended up crying during the committee hearing when he was thanking the Capitol Police officers for their bravery. Now, I think that the Capitol Police officers were certainly brave in the way that they ultimately stood and protected the members of the House of Representatives from both sides of the aisle. And it shouldn't be about that, but the political drama and the political theater that folks like Kinzinger and Cheney are bringing to the Select Committee, I think, deteriorates its credibility.
How much longer is this going to be drawn out? Where does the committee go to from here? Are we going to have weeks and weeks of testimony so that it just continues?
On one hand, Congress is about to head into its August recess. The congressional recess will last probably about 5 weeks unless something, an emergency, pops up and they call folks to come back to Washington. But right now they're expected to return after Labor Day. And so that select committee can basically do its work indefinitely and continue to beat the crap out of Republicans that have continued to defend Donald Trump and the conservatives and really the folks that were there that day protesting the 2020 election results. Everything that happened on January 6th, it was quite unfortunate. But to say that these folks are enemies of the state, which you've got some members of the House that have called Trump supporters enemies of the state. You had a New York Times reporter actually said that this last week as well. And I think that it only breeds a stronger division among the American people when we start saying that folks that actually were exercising their First Amendment rights in terms of peaceably assembling and also petitioning government and speech is a big element of what they were doing too, to call them enemies of the state. Now, if folks were breaking the law, if they were violently rioting, that is very different than peaceably assembling.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott is, of course, with the Club for Growth, and he joins us each week. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we have over 500,000 members from all 50 states. If your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The Cuban government shut down internet communications to hinder that nation's growing freedom movement. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says the United States might be able to help get it back.
When thousands of Cubans took to the streets last month to protest the failures of the island nation's communist government, pictures and videos captured on cell phones told the world what was happening. Well, at least it did until the Cuban regime cracked down on mobile internet access in an attempt to quell the protests. In what's by now a familiar pattern for political upheaval in the iPhone age, Twitter, WhatsApp, and other social media messaging services that were used by dissidents to organize on a large scale were quickly shut down by the communist regime in Cuba. That's almost inevitable, as governments across the world have responded to protests and demonstrations by trying to cut off internet service or block the use of certain apps, as the Cuban government did in mid-July. When that happens, there's usually not much that anyone can do about it, certainly not much the United States can do about it. But Cuba happens to be just 90 miles from Florida. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. We're taking a close look at the case for beaming internet service into Cuba, the way in which the United States might be able to help Cubans get around the internet blackout that's been imposed by their government and perhaps help the pro-democracy organizations and protests that are happening. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has become kind of the prime champion of this effort to improve internet access for the Cuban people. He wrote a letter to the White House last month urging President Joe Biden to provide all necessary authorizations, indemnifications, and funding to American businesses to help get Cubans back online. And DeSantis noted that the goal is not just a political one, but also a personal one. The crackdown on internet access in Cuba has left many Floridians without the ability to communicate with their loved ones back on the island. DeSantis has become one of the leading advocates, along with Representatives Maria Salazar and Carlos Jimenez, both of whom are Cuban-American, for this radical plan to beam mobile internet service into Cuba from balloons anchored offshore that would serve effectively as temporary cell phone towers. It's an idea that would rely on the technological know-how of Google and the diplomatic might of the United States. And even though it might be of some limited value, it also might, as DeSantis put it in his letter to Biden, be the key to finally bringing democracy to Cuba, and all without the need for military intervention. The diplomatic and political dynamics here are actually a bit more straightforward than they might at first appear. There are plenty of precedents for beaming signals across international borders against the wishes of another government. There was Radio Free Europe during the Cold War, of course, but the better comparison here is probably Radio Television Marti, which is run by the U.S. Agency for Global Media, that has been broadcasting news into Cuba since the 1980s. So clearly the U.S. has no qualms about whatever international laws it might be violating by sending television signals into Cuba. And sending mobile internet signals is just a difference of degree. It's just a slightly different wavelength of light, ultimately. And that should not require a total overhaul of U.S. policy towards Cuba. Still, due to the diplomatic issues involved, any effort to beam internet into Cuba would have to be cleared by the White House. It would have to come from the top. Earlier this month, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the Biden administration was, quote, actively pursuing measures to make internet more accessible to the Cuban people. But just last week, she sounded a bit less optimistic about it when asked for an update on how all that was going. She says the Biden administration is exploring a range of options and that it feels that if we can get it done, that would be a great step forward and beneficial to the people of Cuba. That's all quite true, but as Zaki correctly suggests, the technological hurdles here are in some ways more complicated than the political ones, but they are not insurmountable. When DeSantis first called on the White House to deliver internet service to Cuba earlier this month, he nodded towards satellite-linked connections like a program being developed by SpaceX called Starlink. Starlink would rely on low-level satellites in stationary orbit to beam high-speed mobile internet to parts of the world that are inaccessible for traditional cell phone towers. Unfortunately, the service requires small satellite dishes on the ground to act as receivers. That's not a problem in rural Kansas or the middle of Idaho, but it's not really a viable option in Cuba at the moment because there's no way to get the receivers in there. So the discussion about beaming internet into Cuba quickly turned to a more earthbound option, Project Loon. Now, Project Loon was originally developed by Google before being partially scrapped earlier this year for just not being economically viable. It was a pre-Starlink attempt to bring mobile internet to rural areas by attaching antennas to weather balloons that could function as de facto cell towers floating more than 10 miles up into the atmosphere. The idea has only really been tested in the real world on a large scale once. That was in Puerto Rico back in 2017 after the island was hit by two devastating hurricanes, but it did show some promise. And a 2018 test showed that a fleet of Loon balloons could maintain a connection over 620 miles. Again, Cuba is just 90 miles from the United States. That doesn't mean it's a slam dunk, though. Signals could be jammed by the Cuban government, which already tries to block Radio Televisión Martí as much as possible. Many Cuban cell phones may not be able to connect due to differences in network protocols. Think about if you have a SIM card in your phone for Verizon, you can't connect to AT&T's network. It would be that same sort of issue. And whatever connectivity is possible with Loon would be slow and somewhat spotty, at least by American standards, although it would probably be faster than what most Cubans are used to. But it would be worth making the attempt anyway, even with all these technological hurdles, particularly because the technology already exists and it could be deployed for minimal cost to the federal government. There's little to be lost and much that could be gained, not just in Cuba, but in other fights against tyrannical regimes around the world. Internet shutdowns are increasingly becoming a tool of tyranny for authoritarian regimes around the globe. Brendan Carr, a commissioner at the FCC, told Reason last week, "America must stand against this anti-democratic tactic and move with haste to provide internet freedom to the Cuban people." I couldn't agree more. I think this is one of those projects that may not work out, may not actually bring freedom or democracy to Cuba, but certainly it can't hurt to try, and certainly it can't hurt to send the signal, if you will, that America will support these sorts of efforts to take down communist regimes wherever they may be, especially when they're just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of what's going on in Cuba and what's going on here in America as well at the White House and in Congress at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Media bias is on full display in how the legacy news media reports on both the efforts to audit the 2020 election results and its coverage of the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The legacy media love to use the word partisan as a disqualifier. The implication is that if anything is partisan, it should be seen as so self-serving of the party in question that it should be dismissed from any serious consideration as valid or truthful. But the use of the term partisan is highly selective. The Arizona 2020 election audit is invariably described in this way, as are most references to the election reviews in various forms taking place right now in four other states. Here are a few samples. From the Washington Post, a partisan audit in Maricopa County. From Forbes magazine, the U.S. Department of Justice cautioned states on Wednesday that undertaking partisan election audits like the one underway in Arizona could violate federal law, sending a warning shot to states as more Republican state lawmakers move forward with their own controversial probes. CBS in Phoenix. The team running the unprecedented and partisan audit into the 2020 election said Tuesday that they are done counting ballots and are prepared to return them to Maricopa County later this week. the Brennan Center. More than 7 months after Arizona officials certified the 2020 presidential election results, the state Senate's ongoing partisan review of Maricopa County's results has received national attention. But what's happening in Arizona is not an isolated incident. Just this week, the press reported that a Pennsylvania legislator has launched efforts to conduct a similar review there. In each state, the partisan review efforts have taken different forms and are in different stages. On the other hand, the recent hearings by the Special Congressional Committee on the January 6th assault on the Capitol building, appointed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are treated as if they were as free of bias as Lady Justice herself, the famous statue depicted as wearing a blindfold to assure objectivity. Yet I would argue that the January 6th committee was composed by Pelosi with a transparently partisan agenda. Her Democratic appointees were selected from her most loyal supporters, while her two rhino Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, were selected precisely because they line up with partisan Democrats in their public contempt of President Donald Trump. She rejected two appointees suggested by her Republican counterpart, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, namely Congressmen Jim Jordan and Jim Banks. Yet where can you find any legacy media mention of the partisan makeup of that committee? Instead, the major media all respectfully refer to it by the term Select Committee, as if the appointments were based on some form of merit. It is indeed a Select Committee, but in another sense. It is a committee hand-selected by Nancy Pelosi to be as reliably partisan as she could make it. The very definition of a Congressional Select Committee requires that the selection be made by leaders of both parties, but not this one. Speaker Pelosi even acknowledged that fact by referring to her decision to reject McCarthy's appointees as unprecedented, and then went on to explain why this unprecedented move was necessary, citing statements and actions made by the pair that she felt would impact the integrity of the committee. McCarthy said of these actions, "Never in the history of Congress has a speaker done that. It just makes the whole committee a sham and the outcome predetermined." Other than the occasional mention of this one remark by Leader McCarthy, virtually no subsequent media coverage suggests that the so-called Select Committee is anything but the purest arbiter of truth. The American public should demand the same of both election reviews and the January 6th Capitol assault probe. And it should become a mantra for all those of all political persuasions who love our country. Get the facts out. All the facts. Yet the public is being so ill-served by its major media that both are being equally dismissed as business as usual in Washington. We deserve higher integrity from our media and our legislators. The consent of the governed, in Thomas Jefferson's insightful and memorable phrase, hangs in the balance. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including 105.7 in Thousand Oaks, California, along with WBFG-AM and WZLT-FM in Lexington, Tennessee. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.